supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. This week, President Donald Trump endorsed Pennsylvania Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey's legislation blocking sanctuary cities like Philadelphia from getting some federal funds. WHYY's Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
On Tuesday, Toomey was one of a handful of lawmakers invited to the White House to discuss so-called sanctuary city policy. Philadelphia and other cities only hold immigrants on behalf of federal authorities when they provide a judge's warrant. In the meeting, Toomey spoke frankly with Trump as the TV cameras rolled.
Mr. President, the idea that certain municipalities and jurisdictions in the United States confer a special legal protection on violent criminals because they came here illegally, that is a breed of madness that the vast majority of my constituents...
It is rather incredible.
They just cannot understand and cannot support.
Toomey is sponsoring a bill to cut off certain funds to cities like Philadelphia that have enacted policies that the Department of Justice says hampers its efforts to detain and deport illegal immigrants. While Philadelphia has won a court case over the dispute, Toomey's proposal would breathe new life into their effort.
Legal immigrants in this country often live amongst people who are here illegally, and their lives are threatened by this policy.
There's limited research on crime rates in sanctuary cities versus other cities, but the studies that have been done show no statistically significant difference in crime rates. Philadelphia and other cities say they need sanctuary policies to ensure that immigrants feel comfortable calling the police when they're the crime victims. Democrats from the region are up in arms over Toomey's efforts, especially now that the Department of Justice is suing the entire state of California over its sanctuary policy. Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey is one of the fiercest critics of such efforts.
Well, it's beyond surreal. You would think that the Department of Justice would have a lot bigger issues to fry, like gun trafficking in our country, like gangs, like a whole host of issues of foreign interference in our country, but they go after a state based upon the state's right to decide how it's going to execute its laws.
While Trump keeps trying to enact such restrictions, others say the Philadelphia court win should be a warning to the administration that such policies are valid.
I think it's a non-starter.
That's Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Dwight Evans, who says Toomey and Trump are playing to the right wing of their party.
I think they're talking to a certain audience within the country, right?
Philadelphia Congressman Brendan Boyle says the Trump White House is taking America backwards in regards to immigrants.
This administration is the most anti-immigrant in at least 100 years. There's no question that they're going to continue doing things, whether it's against California or other municipalities or states, that are all drived at targeting immigrants. I really wish that this president understood American history better, understood that we are a nation of immigrants.
Some Republican members of Congress with lots of immigrants in their districts are critical of sanctuary policies. Ryan Costello represents parts of four counties west of Philadelphia, including Chester County. Under newly drawn district maps, he would represent agriculture areas with sizable immigrant populations. But he has no sympathy for Philadelphia's policy.
Philadelphia should communicate, right? I think you reach a certain point in time where the city of Philadelphia would come to the realization that they do have to follow the law there, and they have to report if they pick up someone who does not have the proper paperwork. Otherwise, you're sanctioning the non-enforcement of existing law.
But Costello says he'd rather see Congress and the White House focus on a broader immigration proposal that also dealt with so-called dreamers, unauthorized immigrants brought to this country as children.
I would like to see the Senate get a comprehensive immigration bill that's bipartisan. The more votes they have over there, the better, and that be the basis for having a bill pass the House.
Senator Toomey's proposal on sanctuary cities has failed twice, but he's not giving up, especially now that President Trump is backing the plan so strongly. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Neither Republicans nor Democrats in Congress are praising the $1.3 trillion budget plan, which might make the public pleased that at least they met somewhere in the middle. Let's take the public polls with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, we'll get into this massive plan, but first, what does the public think of those who craft it, their lawmakers in Washington?
Well, not too highly. 15% is the current job approval rating for Congress. Now, after this, maybe it will go up when we measure it in April, but that 15% is pretty dismal. 9% was the all-time low for that, which came back in November 2013. But we'll see what happens going forward. Congress simply has a very difficult time trying to buy affection from the American public.
They also have a very difficult time reining in the federal deficit. First, the tax reform bill, and now this. Is that even a concern to Americans at this juncture?
Very few Americans, like 2%, mentioned the deficit, so it's certainly not top of mind. But we just included it in the list of worries. And federal spending in the budget deficit was actually second on the list. Americans worry most about health care. But then 51% of Americans said they worry a great deal about spending in the deficit. So when we remind people about the deficit, it seems to be a real issue, but it's certainly not top of mind.
Tomorrow is a scheduled demonstration in Washington, D.C. in the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida mass shooting. To what extent are guns an issue?
Well, 51% say they worry a great deal about the availability of guns. That's near the top, not at the top, but near the top of things that Americans worry about, at least based on what we asked them. We also found, when we most recently said, what's the most important problem facing the country, unlike the deficit, quite a few Americans actually mention guns and gun violence as the top problem. It's still a little below dysfunctional government, but it's the second most frequently mentioned problem now.
Frank, you've yet to mention the economy, and once upon a time, that was always the most important issue.
That's absolutely correct. There were times when, on all of our measures, jobs, unemployment, the economy was at the very top of the list, but right now, it's at the very bottom of the list. Very few Americans now mention unemployment and jobs as the top problem, and as you say, if we go back to 08, 09, 2010, that was up near the top.
Frank, in our time left, what do you say we talk about the weather? There have been four nor'easters in our region, and although we're waiting for spring, the temperatures are still subnormal. To what extent do Americans think this has been a cold winter?
Interesting question. We've asked off and on over the last 5 or 6 years. Was this winter colder, warmer, about the same as previous winters? And this is across the country, not just in our area, but 29% of Americans said it was colder, but 36% said warmer, and the rest said about the same. That's a change from 2016, 2017. In March of those years, we asked the same question, and upwards of 60% in those years said it was warmer than usual. So these things vary, but right now they're telling us that this past winter, kind of average.
I can't imagine that political affiliation has much to do with response to that question, but if we introduce global warming to the mix, I have a hunch it does.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the most divisive issues on the political measure that we track. It's fascinating. It's the jaws of an alligator opening. What do I mean by that? Well, if we go back in time and ask about global warming, Democrats and Republicans were close to one another. But if you imagine a trend line, Democrats concerned about global warming going up, Republicans going down, so those lines are separating more and more and more. For example, 69% of Republicans say that news about global warming has been exaggerated, much, much higher than is the same for Democrats. We also ask a question about scientists. Are most scientists convinced that human activities causing climate change or not? Well, when we ask Democrats, 86% say yes, scientists are sure that global warming is occurring. But among Republicans, only 42% say scientists are sure, and 44%, actually a couple of points more of Republicans, say scientists are unsure. Republicans would tell us that they think scientists don't really know what's causing global warming. So there's some huge differences there, and actually they've gotten a little bigger rather than smaller this year. So it's one of those issues which I think has symbolism for conservatives and Republicans. They're just telling us in the data they're not convinced across a number of measures about the seriousness of global warming and climate change.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Tomorrow is the 38th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador. This year, the anniversary will be a little different because Pope Francis just said Romero will become a saint. Romero became a symbol of the violence in El Salvador's civil war. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna spoke to people in our area with ties to that country and filed this report.
Salvador, an immigrant, Napoleon Hernandez, who lives in South Jersey now, remembers his father listening to Oscar Romero's sermons broadcast all over his home country.
Was the Catholic bishop talking about the news didn't want to talk. He said things you couldn't find in the daily newspaper.
Bishop Romero came from an influential family, but his work with the disenfranchised radicalized him and transformed him into a human rights activist. It also antagonized the military forces under the government. He was gunned down a day after giving a sermon in which he ordered Salvadoran soldiers, in the name of God, to put their guns down and stop their acts of repression.
Les suplico, les ruego, les ordeno en nombre de Dios, cese la represión.
Romero also spoke of the economic injustice between rich and poor.
No es justo que unos pocos tengan todo y la mayoría marginada se esté muriendo de hambre.
It's not fair that a few have everything and the marginalized majority is dying of hunger, he said. Romero was the best known of the Latin American priests who followed liberation theology, says filmmaker and writer Catherine Smith Pyle from Philadelphia. She says liberation theology spread throughout Latin America, urging church leaders to side with people living in poverty instead of government or the powerful.
These were people who were working with poor people, saying it wasn't their fault that they were poor and it wasn't the way things had to be. And so while all of this work was going on within the church and people in the community were involved in it because of their faith in the Catholic Church, at the same time, it was helping to build a consciousness among poor people that things could be different. And so that was really the most important thing about liberation theology. And that is why Oscar Romero became such an important person internationally, because he was a symbol of that movement and he was assassinated for his work in that movement.
Pyle is the co-author of the documentary Children of Memory on the disappeared children in the Salvadoran Civil War. The farmer she interviewed had a lot to say about Romero. One of the people in her film is a man whose family was killed in a massacre in his own town. He talked about Romero as the only voice who fought for their rights.
Monseñor Romero en propio nuestro país fue reconocido como
Monseñor Romero in our country is the guardian angel of the people. The man spent years trying to find his surviving daughter, Claribel, and like other parents looking for the disappeared children, he was never able to get any information on her thereabouts. It's estimated that the Civil War resulted in the disappearance of 8,000 people and about 80,000 dead. The movement to name Romero a saint started right after the war, says Pyle, and it was really important
that he be recognized for the leadership and the hope that they had had because of him. After his assassination, people felt that there was no recourse except armed insurrection. And so that started the war that was a 12-year war. And during that time, many people emigrated to the United States.
Napoleon Hernandez and his family came in 1993.
Because, you know, that we were in war, it's never going to stop. And I have family, and I decided to move on. You know, no future for me or for my kids.
Hernandez manages a cleaning service business in New Jersey. Like other Salvadoran Catholics, he's elated at having a new saint born in his country.
When Pope Francis said, "You have a saint," we couldn't believe it. My heart and my community are happy. We are very, very happy.
Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
This weekend, Christians will observe Palm Sunday, marking the day Jesus entered Jerusalem to an adoring crowd waving palm leaves in his honor. One church in Philadelphia has decided not to use palm leaves, also called fronds, in favor of ornamental grasses. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the change fits that congregation's environmental theology.
At over 250 years old, St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Philadelphia's Society Hill is an historic landmark, but one that's not afraid to change. For Palm Sunday, Reverend Claire Nevin Field had been using palm fronds that were sustainably grown.
But even given that, most of them were imported from Central America or driven on trucks from Florida. That still is a pretty big carbon footprint. There's got to be stuff growing around here that we could use.
This Sunday at church, Nevin Field's congregants will be waving miscanthus. It's an ornamental grass native to Asia and common in this region. It grows in tall clumps and dries like a reed. It fits the message of the church, where Nevin Field often preaches a theology of ecology in which environmental sustainability trumps tradition.
This is actually an ancient message of Christianity, but one that we have turned away from and lived into the idea that what I think is a gross misread of the Genesis story, that humans were given dominion and therefore we're supposed to just use everything for whatever we want. The Genesis story talks about dominion, but it's dominion in the image of God. God does not trash things.
Although issuing the palm, St. Peter's will not change the name. It'll still be called Palm Sunday. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Villanova Wildcats have their sights set on San Antonio next weekend. Standing in the way of a Final Four appearance are two men's NCAA basketball rivals, starting tonight with the West Virginia Mountaineers, tip-off a little over an hour from now. Joining me from Boston, where he's covering the East Regional Tournament game, is Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News staff writer Joe Giuliano. Joe, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Great to be back, Dave. Thank you.
This is touted as a great offense versus a great defense. Who wins in a game like that?
Well, it's interesting. The saying is that whoever inputs his will on the other is the one who wins. Villanova, as you mentioned, has the top offense in the country. They lead the nation in scoring. West Virginia has a great defense that's led by their full-court press, which is drawn for them the nickname nationally of Press Virginia. Get it? Press Virginia? The idea is to speed Villanova up and rush them into taking hurried shots and to funnel their guys who drive to the basket into a big shot-blocking center that they have named Sagabu Kunate. So that's going to be an interesting matchup to see how the Villanova offense deals with the West Virginia press.
That Villanova has had several days to prepare for this game indicate that perhaps they won't get as rattled as otherwise.
Well, that would be the thought, but the thing that coaches will tell you when they practice for a defense that they haven't seen all year is that the players that they have, the reserve players who will be playing the part of the West Virginia defense, aren't nearly as good or as accustomed to operating this press as the actual team itself. So they've done their best trying to figure out how to find openings. And Jay Wright had a good quote. He gave it to us on Monday, and he also said it yesterday. He said, it's going to be like a boxing match. We're going to go in there and absorb a punch or two from them and see what we have to do to adjust and then go from there.
This has certainly been the season of upsets, as there are every year, but Virginia made history this tournament, and not in a good way.
Oh, no, they became the first number one seed to lose to a number 16 seed since the tournament expanded to 64 teams in 1985. And it wasn't only the fact that UMBC defeated Virginia, it's that they defeated them by 20. There was nothing close about the game.
Looking at the brackets here, it seems that, unfortunately for Villanova, they're in the half where most of the favorites still exist.
That's correct. The Villanova-West Virginia game tonight is the first game of a doubleheader, and the second game features the number two and number three seeds, Purdue and Texas Tech, and they're both very tough teams. If Villanova should be fortunate enough to come out with a win tonight, Purdue and Texas Tech would be two formidable opponents, no matter who was the victor in the game.
Everybody loves an underdog. Think the Super Bowl champion Eagles. Conversely, has success bred complacency, if not among the teammates, maybe on campus or in the Philadelphia region at large?
I know Jay Wright does not allow complacency to sit in for his team. Whether it's real or imagined complacency, he is always on top of his players, making sure that they're doing the right things in practice and off the court. He's a very demanding coach. I mean, he gives a very congenial presence in public in front of the media. But behind the scenes in the practices and during games, he gets very worked up if anyone makes a mistake. He's got a set culture, a set bunch of ideas that he imparts on all of his kids that come through there, even excellent players who may want to come to Villanova. Jay lays it out to them straight and says, you know, this is what we do, and if you don't think you can handle it, that's fine. But we just want to give you the idea of what we do and give you the choice of whether you want to come here or not.
Jalen Brunson and fellow junior Mikal Bridges presumably played a couple of years back when they won the championship. Were either of those two a factor then? And also, how often does it happen anymore that a college player wears two championship rings?
I don't really recall. I think Florida won back-to-back championships about 12, 13 years ago, and that was pretty impressive. But for a team to win two in a row or even two in 3 years is quite a feat as well. As far as Jalen and Mikal, Jalen Brunson was a starter on that 2016 team, but Ryan Arcidiacono was the lead guard who controlled the offense. And as for Mikal Bridges, he came off the bench as more or less a defensive specialist. In the game they played against Kansas that Villanova won to get to the Final Four in 2016, Mikal Bridges had like one of the all-time best defensive performances in Villanova history. It was really amazing how a freshman could contribute that much to a team of veterans and to get them to Houston for the Final Four.
Joe, I only hope that we have reason to call you this time next week from San Antonio.
Well, I'll be available. Thank you, Dave.
Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News staff writer Joe Giuliano on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant News Director, Katie Colinari. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. At the helm this week, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.